Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs. I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 20th of August. Coming up on the program, a top virologist on the Mpox global emergency, dealing with toxic stress in the workplace, how South Africa leads the world in corporate governance, a new book on Judge Mervyn King, and another way of dealing with children's overuse of cell phones. The World Health Organization appealing for support this week by declaring the latest Mpox outbreak in Africa an international health emergency. But there are growing concerns that there is not enough money to tackle the potentially lethal virus. Professor Wolfgang Preisser is head of the Division of Medical Virology at Stellenbosch University and is first up on the program. Professor, good afternoon to you. And why has the recent outbreak in Africa then escalated, in your opinion, to an international health emergency?
This is in recognition of its potential impact going forward. We have learned the hard way how something which seems to be confined to some Central African place can then spread internationally. And that was in 2022, when the previous Mpox outbreak started, which had been going on in Nigeria for about 5 years already. Largely unrecognized and much neglected. And then suddenly cases were being seen in continents that had previously never seen monkeypox cases before. So something had changed profoundly. And what we are worried about now is that the ongoing outbreak in Eastern Congo would have the same tendency if it is allowed to fester uncontrolled. And this is why I'm very glad that the Africa CDC and then followed a day or two later by WHO, have declared these emergencies, because that now allows to mobilize resources and hopefully bring the problem under control before it spreads further.
And Professor, if it is not controlled, what would the speed trajectory be like?
That is very difficult to predict. Sometimes these outbreaks really don't move much for prolonged periods of time, and then sometimes it goes very rapidly. We've seen that in 2022, and you might remember that at the time, for almost a year, WHO already declared a public health event of international concern then, which was then recalled about a year later in 2023, when the case numbers were really coming down fast. But at the beginning of this, there were some events that really seeded the infection across many countries. So in the end, 116 countries were affected by monkeypox, of which maybe 16 or maybe even fewer than that had previously had any cases. So this just shows the enormous potential. And if you look at case numbers, the United States and Brazil and some European countries are, you know, badly affected or were badly affected 2 years ago. And those are countries where the virus does not occur naturally, where you cannot acquire it from small mammals, rodents, as is the case in some parts of Central Africa. So unexpected and sometimes moving very fast. And that is the motivation behind these declarations now, to try and control it there where it is, in Eastern DRC and some neighboring countries, and not allow it to reach the global stage.
And Professor, are you confident in South Africa's ability to handle the situation?
I believe that here in South Africa, we are actually quite well set up. I also work in a diagnostic laboratory, and I know that we are getting regular reports of suspected cases that are then have samples referred that are being tested, in our case at the National Institute for Communicable Diseases in Joburg, and the vast majority of them turn out negative. And that is a good sign. It basically means that clinicians are aware of the issue and they rather exclude it rather than miss a case. And in fact, that is a testament to a good surveillance system if you have many of these cases turning out negative, because you'd rather test 20 times too many than one time too few and miss a case and allow it to spread. So I think we are quite well set up for the time being. And we have, you know, experienced something which is not related to the current outbreak in East Congo, but it's related to the global spread that started in 2022 and which seemed to come under control. This is not gone. So there are still smaller numbers of cases occurring in many places in the world. And after a break of over a year, we've also seen over 20 cases of the other mpox here in South Africa since the beginning of this year, which tragically include 3 deaths, which show that even this West African clade, or clade 2 as it is called, that caused the international outbreak, can also kill people. It's not a mild illness necessarily, and particularly people with weakened immune systems are at high risk of severe disease and death. The bad thing is that the outbreak in Eastern Congo, for which the emergency has been declared now, is caused by the clade 1 virus, which is more pathogenic. That means the risk of severe disease and death is much elevated compared to the clade 2 virus. So that is definitely something we don't want to see spread.
And Professor, how concerned are you about a perceived lack of funding which could negatively impact efforts to contain the outbreak?
Well, I'm actually very concerned. If you look at the figures, the confirmed cases in Eastern Congo are a fraction of the suspected cases. And that basically means that the vast majority of cases that are likely or could be monkeypox, could be mpox, are not being tested. And that's a huge problem. Firstly, because amongst these large numbers, there may hopefully be cases of something else, which are then not diagnosed adequately. But also it means that the real cases of mpox are not recognized and the necessary measures are not being taken. And that's a big problem. So it starts with making diagnostic testing available, and then it goes on to controlling, to checking on contact persons of the infected, providing vaccines to risk groups. And the vaccines are available, but far too few and not in the places where we need them now. And there's also treatment for severe cases. So a lot can be done, but all of that requires a lot of funding. One has to say the Eastern Congo is, of course, a very problematic area. If you look at the infectious diseases that are rampant there now, they're dealing with 2 different strains of poliovirus, measles and cholera, all at the same time as mpox. And of course, this is a region that's beset by civil strife and warfare. So it's not an easy place to work at, but it does require a concerted effort, hopefully able to bring this under control before it spreads further.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Wolfgang Preisser, head of the Division of Medical Virology at Stellenbosch University. I do appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
There is no question that Mervyn King is one of the country's best legal and business minds and has transformed the global business landscape. Long before it was fashionable, King advocating reporting on society and the environment and not only on profit. Journalist, broadcaster and historian David Williams recounts his story in a new book called The Corporate Revolutionary and joins me now. David, welcome. And a lot of our listeners are either small business owners or simply in senior and mid-management. They don't own companies necessarily. Why should they be concerned about governance?
That's a great question, Jeremy, because a lot of people think governance is not for them. And they do also think it's a box-ticking exercise and that it's boring and we don't really need to worry about it. But in fact, governance is about how the company is run. And if you want your company to be well-run, to be run according to the right values, to trade honestly, to declare your income to the tax man and so on, and to have a value-based business, in other words, friendly to the environment, friendly to people, friendly to society? Are you adding value to society as a company, not just in your product? As soon as you think of governance like that, you have to be interested in it, because to say that you're not interested means that you don't care how your company runs, whether it's ethical, whether it does damage to people and the environment, whether your products are suitable for export into society and so on. And Mervyn King's point was that this is not just for listed companies, although it's very important for listed companies. It's for all entities. So if you're on the parent association at a school, the question could be asked, is your executive committee being run according to the principles of good governance? It applies everywhere, and it's not difficult, but you have to get your mind around it.
And David, there's such a delicious irony, because there have been so many failures of corporate governance in South Africa in recent times, yet we lead the way when it comes to the template for corporate governance right around the world.
Yeah, it's a lovely irony, that. And what's interesting in the book is I do write about some of the corporate failures, including Steinhoff. And you can trace the failures back to governance, either because the governance structures were not right. And it's quite a complicated thing. But Steinhoff had a two-tier board. So the non-executive directors were one step removed from the actual operations of the company, which goes a long way to explaining why Marcus Uster was able to get away with so much. So it's either structures, but more often it's that individuals in the governance structures, the leaders of the company, the directors, the managers, are not applying their mind. They are careless. And of course, in the case of some of them, actually deliberately criminal. And it's quite hard when you've got a few people colluding to commit criminal acts against the company, quite hard to track them down, whatever governance you've got. But the lesson is, particularly non-executive directors, but also executive directors, managers, and indeed all employees, need to ask themselves, is this company doing the right thing? Are they asking the right questions about what the managers are doing? And obviously, the more complex the operation, the more skeptical and naive, in a sense. Mervyn King talks about intellectually naive questions. And he says, it's not how much money you make, it's how you made your money that has now become the key question. Mm.
Talking about intellectually naive questions, David Williams, I have interviewed Judge King on one or two occasions, and he has really frightened me, because as you said at the launch in Johannesburg, you've got to bring your A game and all your intellectual marbles. You also go on to say that he is in the pantheon of great South African business exports, and he's revered by academics, business leaders, and, as I read in the book, even Prince Charles, or King Charles now.
Yep. Now King Charles, and I wish he'd been King Charles, then we could have talked about Mervyn King meeting the King in London.
Oh, you wish.
He did
yeah.
meet the King in 2012, the Prince of Wales Trust, now obviously King Charles, very, very supportive of the new integrated reporting, sustainability reporting, so there was lots of alignment there. But as you say, when you go to see Mervyn King, you pull yourself together mentally. You need to be on your game. But I actually wrote about this some time ago in the Financial Mail, and I've repeated it in this book, now adding Mervyn King. There are two South African companies which I believe, and I'd like to know if anyone has any others, are world pioneers and have actually led the world, not only in how they've done their business, but in creating a company that is unique, maybe then copied by others. The one is Sasol, which managed to commercialize the technology of getting oil from coal and therefore petrol. And Sasol remains a global company. I mean, 40% of the petrol in Gauteng comes from Sasol. It's a strategic company. The other is Discovery. Adrian Gore, a brilliant idea of rewarding people for being well instead of being sick when it came to medical aid and insurance. And the result is Discovery, a world leader actuarially and in many other ways in the medical insurance business. And the third, I believe, is Mervyn King. The title of the book is Corporate Revolutionary, because he has actually achieved a revolution in the way companies are governed, in the way they are reported on. And essentially, the world follows what began as the King Codes in South Africa and was turned, really, with a lot of support from the international accountants and the governance organizations in America and Europe, He's turned it into the way business is done now. It is a revolution in how business is done. And to come back to your first question, those people in small companies or middle managers need to know what's going on in governance, because it can actually help, first of all, help their companies to know that they are practicing good governance, and secondly, help their own careers to know what this environment is demanding and how to be good at it.
David, let's pivot slightly. I want to reference Judge King's relationship with Nelson Mandela. You write in the book that at the start of the King Codes of Corporate Governance, when the idea was first being touted, Mervyn King felt he was too busy to do this, but you say he was persuaded to do so by Nelson Mandela himself. But of course, many years prior to that phone call, he knew Nelson Mandela as an attorney in downtown Johannesburg.
That's right. And there are not many people who can say they knew him. A lot of people claim they've met and were friends with Mandela. Not many can claim they go back to the 1950s and the early 60s before Nelson Mandela was sent to prison. And I think it's worth mentioning the whole point about Mervyn King's being equipped to deal with governance, apart from his intellect, is his stellar career as a lawyer and then as a businessman. So both of those equipped him. And it was as a young lawyer that he met Nelson Mandela. They had rooms next to each other in the center of the city. And he used to chat to him on the way to their work every day. So there was a relationship. And then when the Institute of Directors asked Mervyn to create a code of governance for South African companies in the early 90s, particularly with apartheid going and a new economic dispensation coming, the Institute felt that you really needed some guidance on how companies should be run and to transform the business environment. I mean, basically, the economy was run by aging white guys in those days, and things were going to change. And the Institute asked Mervyn, as I say, very well equipped to do this job. He was still then in the business world. And he said, look, you know, he's a very busy man. He remains a very busy man. And I don't know if the Institute contacted Nelson Mandela or Nelson Mandela heard of this himself. And he phoned Mervyn and he said, you've got to do this. And he said, Mervyn said, well, you know, you don't say no to Mr. Mandela. And so he took on the job and then got a lot of other people involved. But interestingly, and it's no surprise to hear what Mandela said to him, he said, when you do this job, which resulted in the King Codes of Corporate Governance, the four different iterations of that, books and all the things I've talked about, you mustn't charge for it. And all the people you get to help you, they will not do it for money. Mm. And I think that's a brilliant insight from Mandela. It's just saying, if you got people, yet another gravy train for people to get onto, you're not going to get the result you want. You need people to do this because they believe in it and they're not doing it for the money. And Mervyn says very proudly that all the people he's involved with over the years, from the JSC and the senior accountants and lawyers and all the people in South Africa and elsewhere, he said every one of them has come on board to do it for nothing.
There is a great quote on the back of the book, which I think summarizes the entire thing. You cannot separate, says Mervyn King, the economy from the planet or from people. The book is called The Corporate Revolutionary. The author is David Williams and the publisher is Tafelberg. David, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
In this Women's Month, there is now a new debate about mental health in the workplace. Is it ignored? And if companies don't pay enough attention, what's the long-term impact? Professor Renata Skuman is head of healthcare leadership at Stellenbosch Business School and joins me now. And Professor, do you think mental health is still being ignored in most workplaces, particularly during this month? And if so, why?
I think one of the first things is that there's many, many organizations that have made great strides, especially since COVID, which really spotlighted the impact and the importance of mental health in the workforce. I don't doubt that most companies agree that it is an ethical and moral imperative to look after your workers, but often companies do not understand the financial implications if we do not take care. And then specifically then with a focus on Women's Month is that there's unique challenges faced by women in the workplace. They have a greater share of juggling work and household responsibilities, which increase the risk for toxic stress. And then also the environment they are exposed to, even during the commute and at work, where we know that women are still exposed to more harassment and microaggressions than their male peers.
Why do you think companies are not connecting the dots when it comes to the financial implications?
I wish I had the answer for that one. I think there is also pushback in the sense of the stigma aspect. So many people think, you know, if we do have these conversations, won't people, A, feel stigmatized, which is actually not the case. The more we know, the more open conversations there is, the less the stigmatization and discrimination against people. That is the one aspect. The second aspect is that leaders in organizations often feel that they have to lead and be brave and be strong instead of being courageous and vulnerable. Because if they are courageous and vulnerable, other employees will also be more willing to speak up. But that psychological safety is another big aspect. And then I think the third aspect is that leaders might think, well, if we have this conversation and we talk about mental health the whole way and how we're going to support you, is that some employees might abuse it.
Do you find that that happens from time to time?
I do. I often, and always when I have this conversation, not often, I always say it is a responsibility of both the employer and the employee to look after your mental health. If you, for example, have been diagnosed with a mental health disorder, but you're non-compliant with your treatment, whether the treatment is therapy or whether it is self-care or whether it is taking medication, you cannot expect your organization then to accommodate you and to bend over backwards to make life easier for you, but you do not put in your own effort. And then also what I do find is that there is in currently a culture of lack of responsibility and accountability where people want to have almost, they don't like a paternalistic system, but at the same time, they don't want a system where they are more accountable also. And unfortunately, yes, I do see people that also then do not take responsibility for their own health and will maximize their sick leave or the mental health days, etc.
Professor Schumann, you use the phrase toxic stress. What is that? And has the nature of stress changed in organizations over the years?
I think we should start with what is good stress. Stress is good for you. If you don't stress, you're most likely not alive anymore. But we talk about eustress. Eustress means healthy stress. That is what's helping you to catch a deadline, to get to a test or exam, or to think on your feet when some interviewer asks you a question. You know, that is all healthy stress. But if you look at what we consider then toxic stress, it is stress that is either severely intense in nature and abnormal by most definitions, or it is very, very persistent over an extended period of time. And that can then cause a physiological response in your body and your brain that have then emotional, cognitive, and physical consequences. And that is what is toxic stress. I think there's a number of things that's contributing, and we can look at risk factors for burnout. We can talk about the socioeconomic environment where there's additional pressures, and then also the impact of technology where people just are always on. But I have to highlight there that people are not always on because they work so hard. It's also how they use their spare time and even their work time to be connected with social media, which then reduce the hours they can productively work and then create a sense of feeling overwhelmed.
Are there new ways that organizations should be integrating mental health initiatives into the overall workplace culture?
Yes, I think there's a lot that in the past that has been done in stress management programs, for example, SMART programs that they call it, and then also workplace mental health talks, and people have mental health walks every now and then, maybe once a year. But I think what it's really needed is that it's embedded in the culture where we look at systems and policies and guidelines in terms of communication, how we communicate with each other, how frequent, what platforms do we use. I feel that all the technology platforms that's available also sometimes give overload in terms of the multiple channel communication. It's also very important that they should look at flexibility. And people often think flexibility just as work from home. But flexibility might be something as simple, where a mother with a child that needs to be dropped at school can maybe just come in after they drop the child and not have to depend on someone else that they need to pay to get the child safe to school, for example. Or to, for example, give a dedicated day a month or half day a month where doctor's appointments can be scheduled. Or you are able to maybe support your child at the school grounds when they have, for example, sports. So those type of flexibility is the conversations that we also need to look at. And then finally also is incredibly, there is still a massive gender pay gap. And if you look at the stats from 2008 to 2021, we actually look worse in South Africa than before. But saying that, I think it is important that we shouldn't see remuneration only as monetary remuneration, but we should also look at the differences in what genders value. And for females specifically, it is the relationship, it is the flexibility that they have. And it's not always just a monetary remuneration when we look at the gender pay gap that we should take into account.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Renata Skuman, Head of Healthcare Leadership at Stellenbosch Business School.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on the program, to technology and Google announcing something called School Time, a new feature for Android phones and other devices designed to reduce distraction for children during school hours. Sia Madikani is Google SA's Communications and Public Affairs Manager and joins me on the program now. And first of all then, what is the problem that you're trying to solve?
Well, this School Time is a new tool to help parents manage their children's screen time and focus during school hours. Really, this is just feedback from parents as well as research that we've done in terms of the use of technology by children. And what came out of it is that parents, as the use of technology continuously increases, parents are seeing the need sort of to get involved and be able to control some of the consumption that their children are partaking, especially when it comes to things like during school time, when people should be focusing on learning and not being distracted by continued use of technology during school or learning hours.
And this is a problem that's not unique to South Africa. It's universal, isn't it?
100%. So School Time Excel is a tool that are available across the world. It's being rolled out from now until the end of the year across the world, not just South Africa. So as you say, rightly correct, pointed out that this is the case across the world.
So how does School Time improve accessibility for parents trying to manage their children's screen time? In other words, Sia, how does this thing work?
So Screen Time is on the front page, so on the home screen of every phone, of every child's phone, we'll see all the apps that the parent is comfortable with that child having access to. So if you, for instance, want the kid to be able to Google certain information, you'd have the Google tab open, being able to search for that information. But all the other stuff that you don't want them access to, so whether that's WhatsApp or it's any other tool, they wouldn't be available on the screen. So School Time is on the home page of the child's phone, and the parent is able to control what's on that homepage through using Family Link, which is another parental control app that we have at Google. So on Family Link, the parent is able to select the apps that they want available on School Time and then be able to sort of switch on and off whenever they feel like the kid should not be able to have access to those. This doesn't go for apps only. It also goes for the numbers that can sort of send messages or call the kid. So those numbers will be able to block. It really gives the parent a bit more control over what their parents has access to.
And Sia Madikani, what sort of response has there been so far, both locally and worldwide?
Well, we've just really recently just announced the launch of School Time. It's really picking up. We don't have the numbers yet in terms of how much usage there is. But what I can say is that at the moment, it's available on the Fitbits, but it's going to roll out to Android devices for the rest of the year. So your Android watches, your phones, your Samsungs, all of those type of devices would be able to have this feature. And it's really great. And I would really encourage parents to take it up and use it to be able to engage with their kids while they're at school. And also can be used as well outside the school periods. So if you, for example, during school holidays, you feel like your kids shouldn't be having access to technology, maybe you want them to go out and play and engage with nature, this is a perfect tool to use to be able to control that.
I'm interested to know why you've extended this to tablets and to smartwatches and that kind of thing. What was the thinking there?
Well, it's the same. Really, it's about access. You know, at the moment, so many things are moving off just being on the phone. Kids are using tablets to study, to read, to engage with the internet, the technology. They're also using watches, as you mentioned, rightly mentioned, to do the same. You know, you're able to receive calls on some of these watches. There's a very technological advance. And as technology improves, really just we're just putting perimeters in place to ensure that they don't have proper free rein. As we know, kids can sometimes just be children, and just making sure that parents have that little bit of control of what their kids are engaging with in the technology world that's continuously sort of becoming part of their lives every more and more so. Yeah. So
and this tool, I think, was good. Why is this so important to Google, given that it would be in your best interests to have people spending as much time online as possible?
Well, you know, our mission, this is really, our mission is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. So you rightly corrected, we probably would be, but we also take things like privacy and sort of trust very important with Google, and really it forms part of that sort of pillar of our work, making sure that we don't just roll out these tools and get people to use them, but we try to get people to use them in a responsible manner, in a way that is beneficial and in a positive sort of results in society. So we don't just want people using these tools at random, like without any limits, you know, like, so we do take privacy very seriously, and we make sure that we put in tools in place for those, you know, especially for children that are still vulnerable and still dependent on their parents to make sure that they guide them.
Just very quickly, well, I understand that you're pushing the corporate line here, and that is important, but you've also been under a lot of public pressure to make these changes.
Well, yes, because, I mean, if our users are demanding these changes, we definitely have to put the changes in. That's exactly that. So, yeah, it might be a corporate line, but what I'm saying is we have to. Privacy is something that our users demand, our users want, and we have to make sure that we give it to them.
I guess it's all about getting ahead of the curve. Siya Madikani, yeah, Public Affairs Manager at Google South Africa, I do appreciate your time today. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.